Come in. All right, thanks a lot. Just to point out some of the topics that we've seen in the last few classes, just to kind of help to focus our minds on the things Isaiah is doing, you'll notice that so many of the things that he's talked about come back to this idea of asking us to take a good, careful, honest look at our lives, what our lives are about, and what God's done, and what God wants to offer us, and ask ourselves, are we willing to embrace what God has offered us? A few chapters ago, we looked at Isaiah's statement that we should lift up our eyes to the heavens. In other words, take a good look at what's going on. Take a good look at this world. Take a good look at the way it deals with its problems. Take a good look at the things that this world thinks are important. And then take a look at God. Take a look at what God does. Take a look at what God considers important. Take a look at what the world offers you and what the world actually gives you. And then take a look at what God offers you and what God actually gives you. He's talked about having our hearts stuck in the world, and this saying that he used back in back in chapter 52, depart, depart, go out from there. God doesn't ask us to leave the world physically, because that's his decision when it's time for us to do that. He does ask for us, as Paul told the Philippians, to consider ourselves citizens of heaven. No longer to consider ourselves citizens of this world or of one of its arbitrary political entities or of some society or group on earth. To consider ourselves a citizen of heaven, to leave the world behind in our hearts. The figurative example frequently used in the Old Testament is to leave behind the things of Egypt, because the people were called out of Egypt. They had a certain kind of false security in Egypt, and a lot of the people, whenever things got difficult, they wanted to go back. But it was time to realize that was not your true home, time to move on. Time for us, likewise, to realize that although we often develop a sense of false security in this world if things are going the way we think they should, God is calling us to something better. As the book of Hebrews calls it, he's got a city with foundation. He's got an eternal city for us. This world is not our proper home. So we should be ready to pull ourselves away. One of the most well-known passages in Isaiah is chapter 53, where it talks about how he bore our iniquities. And of course, we know that finds its ultimate and complete fulfillment in Jesus. It's given here, if you remember the passage, just so many convicting things about what Jesus did and the things that Jesus endured for our sake. Isaiah mentions it in connection with all these other things so that we realize that God has done everything he can to clear the way to him. Our sins, which are such a barrier to our relationship with God, have been removed by the blood of Christ. The lack of understanding we often have has been removed because in Jesus all things are made clear. Jesus didn't come to bring a complicated theological argument or a difficult activity program for us to follow. He came, died for our sins, and simply asked us if we're willing to accept that humbly and gratefully by God's grace. And the last time we talked about God's faithful love, the idea that God, as opposed to all the things we see in this world, can always be counted on. God's always the same. You can always count on God loving you and telling you the truth and all the other things that he does. Those are eternal qualities. And just to take a look back at a couple of the key points, he says in chapter 54, sing, O barren woman, you who never bore a child. Burst into song, shout for joy, you who are never in labor. Because more are the children of the desolate woman than of her who has a husband. A little bit later on, he talks about verse 6, the Lord will call you back as if you were a wife deserted and distressed in spirit, a wife who married young only to be rejected. He talks elsewhere about widows. Other people that in general have been rejected by the world, ignored by the world, patronized by the world. What Isaiah is telling us is that these are exactly the kind of people that God is calling. People who realize their need. People who understand that the things of this world are not for them. Whether they get them or not, it's not really going to meet the deepest need. He's going to mention that again. We'll read in a little bit over in chapter 56. Chapter 56, verse 3 says, let no foreigner who has bound himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people. And let not any eunuch complain, I'm only a dry tree. For this is what the Lord says to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, To them I'll give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. Verse 6, and foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to serve him, to love the name of the Lord, and to worship him, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it and hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Foreigners, eunuchs, widows, barren women, and so forth, anyone who considers himself or herself deprived by the world, ignored by the world, the world's not giving you what you want. Instead of looking to the world and hoping that somehow it'll pay attention to your needs, he's simply saying, realize that you've already got God devoted to meeting your real needs. Not necessarily the needs that you thought you had or the things you desire, but a God who is going to give you what you really need. Because Jesus told us very honestly and directly, what good is it if you gain the whole world and yet forfeit your soul? What good is it? Well, it's no good at all. And the thing about this is that really this is speaking not just to a certain kind of people, but really to everybody, because really everybody is in that same situation, just whether we realize it or not. We may not realize how little this world really does for us. You might not think you're coming out too far behind in this world, or you may think that just with a couple of breaks, you'll be the one on top and you'll be the one getting the things that you want. The sad truth is, even if you do, it's not going to make you as happy as you thought it would. Not going to change you the way that you thought it would. Only God can meet the real needs that are deep in our soul. And God is not looking to reach out to the people who consider themselves the who's who of the world, the movers and the shakers and the powerful people and the rich of the people. And that's good news for us, because there isn't anybody here who's in who's who. Now, there are some of you who are very good candidates if they ever write a book called What's That? You know, a few of you might be in that. But none of us are ever going to be in who's who. And so that's good news. And God says, therefore, that he's going to give us, if you look at a little bit later in chapter 54, verse 11, O afflicted city lashed by storms and not comforted, I'll build you with stones of turquoise, your foundations with sapphires. I'll make your battlements of rubies, your gates of sparkling jewels, and all your walls of precious stones. He's talking about a foundation. He's talking about rebuilding our foundation instead of building it on the shallow and flimsy things of the world, to build it on things that are valuable and lasting and steady and firm. Remember Jesus told the parable about the two people who built houses? Remember he told about the guy that built this beautiful house, except he built it on the seacoast, on the sandy ground, and so when the storm came, that lovely little house washed away. Well, that's what it's like if you build your life on things of this world. Trying to collect the glittering toys that the world has and the impressive wealth that the world has and the power that the world offers. Someday it's all going to get swept away like a house on the sand. And then there was the other guy who built himself a little house on the rock, and so when the storms came, that little house stood secure and firm. That's what he's telling us, that to build your life around God means that you have a real foundation, because you're building on things like grace, love, compassion, mercy, integrity, honesty, security, things that really will last as opposed to things of the world that can disappear in an instant. Then he talks about in chapter 55, he says, come all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Now he's not talking about physical hunger or thirst. He's talking about spiritual hunger or thirst. Remember what Jesus says in the Beatitudes? Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, because they're going to be fulfilled. That's what he's talking about. If you want to have what your soul really needs and what you really deep within you desire and need, come to God, because he will give you milk and wine and honey without cost. You don't even have to pay for them, because it all comes by God's grace anyway. And then he says, why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? Well, there he's talking about the world, because the world's always asking us to do the things that they want us to do and promising us a reward. Promising us that if you just do things our way, we'll give you a reward. You'll be with the in crowd if you do things our way. We'll take care of you if you do things our way. And then the world never really delivers on its promises. You know, down where I work, we've had problems for years with this creaky computer system that we use. It was made years ago, and it was actually, in its time, was a very good computer system. But even when I started working there over 15 years ago, it was already pretty rickety and falling apart. It was pretty antique. And you would say, you would point out to the people in charge of the place, you know, this thing really doesn't do what we need it to do. This thing really doesn't work very well. This part of it doesn't connect with that one. You have to do the same things twice. And they would always tell us the same thing. They'd always tell us, well, you see, we're developing a brand new system. And 5 years from now, we're going to have this whole new system, so we don't want to put our time into fixing these problems now. 5 years from now, we'll have this new system. When I started working back there back in 1990, that's what they would tell us. And when I was working there still in 1995 and said, you know, could we make it so that it does this? We need to do this. You ask us for information on this, but the system doesn't have it. We've got to always track it down. Well, we're working on this new system. 5 years from now, we're going to have this new system, and we're going to include all this stuff in it. Well, in the year 2000, I was still working there. And you would ask them questions, how come the system doesn't do this? Well, we're working on this new system that we're going to have in 5 years, so we don't want to put the time into fixing this one now. Well, last year, they finally told us they had the new system ready. Well, what happened was they gave up on making a new system. They decided it was beyond their capacity, so they just went out and bought one that someone else had made. Well, of course, they didn't make it for us. This new system doesn't do any of the things that we wanted to do, so now, not only do we not get all these things that they kept promising would come every 5 years, you know, like if you know your history of all those Joseph Stalin 5-year plans that kept promising to turn the Soviet Union around. Well, these worked about the same. Well, now we got this new system that someone in an office out in Washington or someplace decided was the computer system you're supposed to use. Doesn't do anything we want it to use. Plus, now we have to learn a whole bunch of new stuff because this new system doesn't do things the way that we do it. So now every time we say, well, you know, we really needed to do this, now they just say, well, that's not part of the new system. Well, this doesn't keep track of this thing that we need. Well, that's not part of the new system. So now we're just going to have that whole thing all over again. And 20 years from now, they'll change another system and they'll have another excuse. That's what the world does to you. Promise, 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 promise. Oh, that's not part of our new system. The new system's going to fix all this. The new system's going to fix all this. Oh, but that's not part of the new system. That's not part of the new system. The world's always promising, I got a plan to fix the economy. We got a plan to fix the education system. We got a plan to take care of unemployment. We got a plan to do this. We got a plan to do that. Oh, but your needs aren't part of our plan. Your needs weren't included. Sorry. And the thing is, even if you don't realize it at the time, what those plans do, even if they don't work so badly on a worldly level, they never meet the things you really need. Because what you really need is not a better job or a safer economy or safer streets. What you really need is to have the eternal security that comes with a relationship with God. What you really need is to have the love and compassion of God in your heart so that you're not swayed by the hatreds and violence of the world. What you really need is to know that God has forgiven you of your sins so that you don't have to compare yourself with other people and compete with other people. And the world's 5-year plans will never take care of those things. Only God does. And that's why he says, come to the waters and drink instead of spending your money on things that don't satisfy. Well, the new passage we're going to look at today has this idea of call on God while he is near. Understand that God has given you the things that you really need. He's offering you the things that you really do need. And it's up to us to call on him. Because most people, even if they say they believe in God, even if they go to church, do the things that Christians are supposed to do, most of those things, we kind of just let ourselves go along with the flow. And what God really very much wants is for you and I to be doing the things that he's asked us to do because we know how much we can trust God, because we know how much we can love God. And this is what Isaiah is saying. Just to give you a little overview, you probably heard some of the things Isaiah says in this chapter. This is another chapter that goes on the Isaiah's Greatest Hits album because it has some familiar things in here. Verse 8, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. The idea that we need to be reminded of God's perspective. One of the reasons why we often don't have the devotion to God or the joy for God that he wishes us to have is because we just don't see things from his point of view. We get stuck in looking at things the way the world has taught us to look at things. And then it's much harder to appreciate what God has done and to be excited about it. If you look in a little bit later in chapter 56, I read these a little bit ago, he talks about how his offer is open for foreigners, for eunuchs, for everyone. Nobody's excluded. And he refers to the process as, down in verse 8, the sovereign Lord who gathers the exiles of Israel. He talks about gathering the exiles. Now you remember, see if you remember back what we talked about in the spring. Isaiah had a word that he used all the time to refer to people that understood what God did for them and who let God lead them. Remember that word?
Remnant.
The remnant, the exiles, that this is what God is looking for, calling out of the world a remnant of exiles who realize that the world is never going to meet their real needs and who realize that they need to put their hope in God and only in God. And everyone, no matter what the world thinks of you, no matter what status you have in the world, no matter what you think of yourself, we are all truly equal in God's eyes, and his offer stands for everyone who responds to him. God doesn't care what the world thinks of you. God doesn't care if the world respects you or appreciates you, because God is willing to give you the same blessings he offers to everyone. And then in chapter 56, the last part, and then through chapter 57, he just gives us some things to think about. He talks about the spiritual landscape that we see, which whether you lived in Isaiah's time or whether you looked in our time, all you need to do is look around and see the hatred, the violence, the crime, the sin, the immorality, and it's very easy to be discouraged. What's difficult is to look at that with some insight and understanding, and to ponder it, to understand what it really means, to use that awareness, that spiritual awareness, not to make you despair, not to make you hate the people who are doing those things, but to help you to see again your need for God and their need for God, how equally we all need God. And this is what Isaiah is going to try to teach us, to cry out to help for God before it's too late, before the time has passed for us to take advantage of the opportunity he's given us for him. Okay, that gives you a little bit of overview. Going back then to the beginning of the passage for this week, up in chapter 55, verse 6, wanted to read this passage. Chapter 55, verse 6, seek the Lord while he may be found, call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the evil man his thoughts. Let him turn to the Lord and he'll have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. You will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and hills will burst into song before you, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush will grow the pine tree, and instead of briars, the myrtle will grow. This will be for the Lord's renown, for an everlasting sign, which will not be destroyed. I don't know if that confuses you, that imagery there at the end of the trees clapping and the mountains singing. That's not supposed to be literal. I hope you get that. You know, Isaiah hasn't gone off the deep end or anything like that. What do you understand what he means by that, though? When he talks about you're going to walk out there in the world and the mountains and hills are going to start singing and the trees are going to start clapping their
hands. Time for rejoicing.
Time for rejoicing, right. And time to rejoice in knowing that you found the purpose for which you were called. Isaiah often uses nature images in his book. And one of his points, again, if you remember back the very first thing Isaiah said in his whole book, he talked about how in this world, everything in nature basically does what?
Gives God glory.
Yeah, gives God glory. Does what God created it to do. Accept God's purpose for it. Even animals that we consider to be foolish and unintelligent, they still do what God wanted them to do. So who's the fool? The animals or us for not doing what God created us to do? And all of nature reflects God's glory. It's only us who has the choice to rebel against God. It's only us who can choose to worship ourselves instead of worshiping God. And so when we humbly and voluntarily accept God as the true purpose in our life, all of a sudden we have found the purpose that God called us for. And nature itself, figuratively speaking, rejoices in that because we finally got it. We finally have stopped rebelling against what God really called us to do. So Isaiah reminds us of God's greater perspective. And it's something that when we read this, you see this thing where it says, okay, God's thoughts are higher than your thoughts. God's ways are not your ways. Well, there's a certain level at which that's easy to understand. You know, we kind of understand that if you were trying to solve some complicated mathematical problem, you probably realize God could figure it out quicker than you, right? Probably realize God could solve 99 times 487 quicker than you can punch it into your calculator. Trust God for that? Probably. You probably know if you're trying to think of what to do with your retirement plan, is there anything out there that you could do that the folks on Wall Street won't lose half your money within the next couple of days? You probably realize that if there is such a thing to do, God probably knows it, right? You probably don't, your broker probably doesn't, but God does. Well, that's good that you realize that about God. But is that all that Isaiah is saying here? Is that God has better calculation ability than you do? He's a little bit better with math, a little bit able to foresee the future a little bit.
He encompasses everything.
It encompasses a lot more than what we're aware of. We should understand that God is not just the great computer up there that calculates all the probabilities and plans farther ahead than we do. It's talking about perspective. It's talking about priorities. It's talking about knowing what really matters. Remember what Isaiah said back in chapter 49 to people who were worrying about the future of Israel? What's going to happen to our country? What's going to happen when the Babylonians attack us? What's going to happen when the Assyrians attack us? Remember what Isaiah said? So that's too small a thing. It's too small a thing. It's not something important in the grand scheme of things, important enough to take your focus off of spiritual truths and spiritual priorities. And this is what he's teaching us. God's thoughts are not your thoughts. It's not just saying, you know, God's got a much better way for you to invest your money than your broker has found for you. It's saying that God knows there are a lot of things that are a lot more important than that. It's not just saying that God could solve that math problem for you that you've been worrying about. God's saying, I know of things a lot more important than that you could spend your time and energy on. It's not God saying, I'm surprised that you guys haven't figured out who to vote for yet. It's obvious to me. God's saying, it's not really that important from my point of view what happens to these worldly affairs. There are things that are very important that no ruler or king or president can affect, and you've got to decide it for yourself anyway. So you better focus your attention on that. And this is something that's very difficult for us to accept because we get caught up, like everybody else, in the things that matter to us, the things the world tells us you got to worry about and panic about. And therefore, we develop a lot of perspectives and beliefs that become very strong emotionally to us, but that we have a very difficult time putting in proper perspective and realizing it's not that big of a deal to God. Our traditions, our worldly allegiances, the things you've been brought up to think are important should all be evaluated in terms of, do they really matter to God that much? Because we can always laugh when we see other people and their traditions and the things that they get all worked up about. You know, you can watch, for example, if they have a football game between Alabama and Auburn. You know, people who live down there will tell you that's just live or die. You know, there was even a commercial I saw once in a senior retirement home where they had a guy with an Auburn sweater and a guy with an Alabama sweater, and the guy with one of them was walking down with his IV trying to stagger across the place, and the other guy tripped him and knocked him down, and it was something that apparently people from Auburn and Alabama thought that was funny because it's such a fierce rivalry. Well, it's silly, isn't it? Because we know that what really matters is Ohio State beating Michigan. What's the point? Point is, to God, they're both equally silly. And be honest with yourself, you Buckeye fans. Was your emotional state last night at 11:30, can you honestly say it was no different from your emotional state at 10:30? Can you honestly say that? You Buckeye fan, you can't say that honestly because you know your emotional state depends on it. Even though you come here every week and listen to me talk about how silly it is to let a bunch of post-adolescents playing around with a prolate spheroid affect your emotional condition, you hear that from me all the time. And you sit there and grumble and think how un-American that is, and you never adapt to it. But it's true. And my dear wife, Cecilia B. DeMille, is a perfect example of that. If you were home a little after 11 o'clock last night and all of a sudden all your domesticated animals dove under a bed or into a closet because they heard this high-pitched noise unhearable by human ears, that was Linda screeching in delight over that last touchdown last night because she lives and dies with her Buckeyes. She loves her Buckeyes. The point is, we've got to realize that all is too small of a thing. The world will grab you by your heart and make you worry, make you excited, make you panic, make you angry about things that matter to them, because it's very important to them to get your allegiance and your loyalty. But we have to rise above that. We have to learn that the things that matter a lot to us may not matter at all to God. They may not make any difference to Him. And sometimes we allow ourselves to get caught up, just like we talked about last week about Ivan Pavlov's experimental dogs, reacting to these stimuli without thinking. And it doesn't always give us the things we need to understand God. Now, I remember when I was in college, I went out of state college and went down to Rice University, the home of the Fighting Owls, down in Texas. And we had a football team down there too. One of the reasons why I just cannot take Ohio State football seriously, although I do watch it, I'm happy when they win because it means when I come to class, people will be in a little bit better mood. But I don't live or die with it, because when I was in college, the team we had, they lost every week. They played these big teams like Texas and Oklahoma and LSU because we were an easy win on the schedule. Because Rice was a small school, they didn't really have much of an athletic program, and students got in free to the games because students weren't going to pay to go to watch their team lose 50-0 every week. Well, we would go to the games. The highlight of the game was always the Rice Band. It was called the Marching Owl Band. And just stop, and there's an acronym that goes with that that you can put together very easily for yourself. Because the Rice Band would always, basically during halftime, they just make fun of the other team, the other school and its traditions. Because we knew not to take ourselves seriously. And it was so funny to see people from Texas and Oklahoma and all these places who took themselves so seriously. You know, they thought that it was so important. You know, Texas football and Oklahoma football. And of course, you know that that's silly too, because you know it's Ohio State football that's really important. So we can look at other people's traditions with a sense of humor. Well, the most tradition-bound team in Texas, if you've ever been down there, Texas A&M University, the Aggies, they are so tradition-bound, and it's so crucial to them. They have zero sense of humor. They have no sense of humor at all about it. And one of the highlights of the season was always when you played the Aggies, because you know you could get them all stirred up. And in the stadium where Rice played was this huge stadium. It's in Texas, you know, so they always make things a lot bigger than they need to be. So there's always more fans from the other teams at our own home games, which just made it more fun to watch their reactions to the band. Well, the Aggies don't have any sense of humor. And there's one year, they still show the tape of this, by the way, to freshmen every year at Rice to help them understand the difference between us and these other schools, not to take things so seriously. Well, they made fun of all the Aggie traditions. You know, the Aggies have this song that they call the Aggie War Hymn. And coincidentally, it's the same tune. If you remember the old Yogi Bear cartoons, Yogi Bear is smarter than the average bear. That's the Aggie War Hymn. They took the music for it. So our band said, we're going to give a tribute to all the great traditions of Texas A&M University. And they started playing the Aggie War Hymn. And then all the band and the students got up and started singing, Yogi Bear is smarter than the average bear. Well, the Aggie fans didn't like that too much. They have what's called, the Aggie band is a military band. It's called the Aggie Corps Band, C-O-R-P-S, because they're very militaristic. They did not appreciate it very much. And you can see the security guards kind of holding them back right there. Well, they went on and they made fun of a lot of Aggie traditions. And you could tell these people were really getting upset. And so they finally, at the end of the show, they said, we're going to do one more number, and we just want our friends from Texas A&M to realize we know how important their traditions are. So we don't want to leave on a bad note. The most sacred tradition of the Aggies is they have this mascot, Reveille. It's a border collie, you know, bred from the greatest border collies in human history, going back, I don't know, to the ancient pharaohs of Egypt or something. So they name it Reveille, and that's their sacred mascot. So they said, we're going to give our tribute to the most beloved Aggie tradition of all, their beloved mascot, Reveille. And the band, formed a fire hydrant and started playing How Dry I Am. Well, the Aggie Corps band stormed the field. They had to get police to hold them off. And at the end of the game, they had to have police escorts to get our band back to their apartments after the game. Now, the thing is, you can realize how ridiculous it is to get that upset just because someone makes a little fun of your traditions. But that's the way we are. We get such a loyalty and allegiances to worldly things that we just can't see it in perspective. We can see how silly someone else's traditions are, but not someone else's traditions. A little more serious example, if you remember the old Twilight Zone show, they had an episode that starred Agnes Moorehead, which I know you probably remember her playing a witch's mother on television, but she's actually a very, very good dramatic actress. And there's one show where she played this elderly woman living out in a farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere all by herself. You're trying to survive all by herself. And she's in the kitchen and she hears this clanking and banging around on the roof. And she starts going up to investigate, and there's this little flying saucer on her roof, and these two little spacemen get out, these two little aliens, and they start shooting at her with their little weapons. And she starts running and hiding, and she starts chasing them around, and it's a whole half hour show, nothing but her being terrorized by these two little space aliens. Their little weapons, all they do, they injure her, but they don't do anything serious. So eventually they find her knife block in the kitchen. And they get out, they're just big enough to wield these butcher knives and chase her around her house with her butcher knives. And every once in a while she'll finally think she's gotten away, and all of a sudden a butcher knife will come through the door or up from under her bed or something like that. And she finally captures one of them and gets rid of one of the things. And the other one finally decides to take off. And the last scene is this other little alien gets up to his spaceship, and you hear him calling in, reporting from planet X95, this planet is inhabited by a fearful race of giants. Don't ever send anyone back here. I think I'm going to be lost. And she you see Agnes Moorehead get this axe and chop up the spaceship just so it can't do her any more harm. And so you think, whew, boy, that was a close one. And then you see on the wreckage of the spaceship, there's a close-up, and it says, United States Space Probe. And all of a sudden you realize, whoa, I've been looking at this from the wrong point of view all around. Because you just assume that loyalty, that this is an American right here holding up under attack from some disgusting, hideous alien planet, and all you have a reason, no, that's probably the way that other people would look at us if we traveled to their planet. And the whole point is, God's thoughts are not our thoughts means not just that God can figure things out better than you can. God looks at things very, very differently. His priorities are very different from ours. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your thoughts. So are my thoughts higher than your thoughts. Then he tells us that the way to have the life and joy that we want, the only way we can have those things in lasting measure is to get them from him. Verse 10, as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and don't return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It won't return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. Why does he use the rain and the snow as an example? What do the rain and the snow do for us?
Nourishes the ground.
Yeah, nourishment, provide life, growth, all these things that we can't get for ourselves. You know, we tend to be pretty focused on how hard we work and the things that we've earned for ourselves, but we don't realize we're dependent on the rain, the snow, the sun, all these things that, who created them?
God
created. That if he decided to take them away, how valuable would all our modern technology be?
Nothing.
If God decided to flip the old off switch on the sun, how long would we survive with all our fancy little gadgets and toys?
11 days.
All right, yeah, the time it takes for the light to stop coming in. I'll let the engineers figure that one out. I always make fun of engineers, so I got to do something to improve my approval rating from the engineers in here. The point that he's saying is to realize life and joy and peace, they only come in lasting measure, in true measure, if you're getting them from God. You can have a lot of fun in this world, but you can't have lasting joy. You can get false security for a time in this world. You accumulate enough possessions, enough money, enough power, you can get a false sense of your security, which will last for a short time. But the only way to really understand what's happening is if you let God and His Word guide you. And that's where this imagery of the singing mountains and the clapping trees comes in, because the singing mountains and the clapping trees means that if you've turned to God, if you realized once and for all, there ain't anything down here that's really going to meet my deepest needs, the rest of God's creation says, hooray, because you got it. You figured it out. You know, you understand it now that this world is not your true home. And that's why the trees and the mountains are so happy. And this is where it comes in, this process of gathering the exiles, as he says it in chapter 56. He says, maintain justice and do what's right, for my salvation is close at hand, and my righteousness will soon be revealed. Here again, God's salvation is close at hand. And one of the things that we learn so often from Isaiah is how truly easy it is to be saved once we understand what God's asking for. We have a very bad habit of making salvation into a program or a method or a theological debate, instead of just stepping back and realizing once and for all, salvation comes by grace. And that means it's close at hand. That's what he had said, in fact, back in chapter 55, verse 7, let him turn to the Lord, and he'll have mercy on him, and to our God for he'll freely pardon. We just need to turn to God in humility, accept the fact that we're not any better than anyone else. We need the blood of Christ as much as the worst murderer or criminal needs it, and accept it humbly. Allow ourselves to be joined with him, to be cleansed by the blood of Christ, and then God forgives us, and we have the great blessings that he offers us, not because we've earned them, but because of God's own character. And this is why he says foreigners and eunuchs are welcome. We read these earlier. He's saying even if you're a foreigner, even if you're a eunuch, you're not excluded. No one's excluded. It doesn't make any difference what the world thinks of you. Now, you might need to think for just a minute, but I think you'll catch this. Why does he single out foreigners and eunuchs here? He says, you guys are welcome in my house.
Well, in the Jewish religion, the eunuchs couldn't go into the worship for once.
Couldn't go into the temple, couldn't be priests. Is that what you were thinking, Don?
Sort of, just that the Jews tended to look down their noses at anybody that think that they're better than everybody else. And I think one thing that God may be trying to get across here, even if it's not the main thing, is, you know, you guys are not better than everybody else. The only way any of you are going to have a relationship with me is through grace.
That's right. That's right. And you see, one of the things that was misunderstood by most of the people was that the purpose of the law was not to prove who was spiritual and who wasn't. Reason why he mentions eunuchs is because there are rules in the law that says, if you're a eunuch, you can't go in the temple. If you're a eunuch, you can't offer a sacrifice. If you're a foreigner, you can't go in the temple. And they misunderstood the point of those laws. They misunderstood the purpose of the law. Because they, and I know we would never do this, this is just one of those things we can chuckle at how primitive people were back then. They thought that the law was just a bunch of rules to see if we could follow it so that we'd get rewarded if we followed it and punished if we didn't. I know we'd never fall into that. I know that we would never fall into the habit of thinking I'm doing better at following the laws than someone else is. But some people think that way. They thought that when it said you've got to meet certain criteria to be a priest, if you're a eunuch or if you have a skin disease, you can't do certain things. They thought what that meant was that if you met these criteria, you were somehow better. They thought when it talked about that you can't eat these things, that somehow there was a superiority involved in not eating those things. We today actually make very similar misconceptions. We look back at all those old laws and think, well, they weren't allowed to eat pigs because it probably would have made them sick back then. No, that's incorrect. There wasn't anything that much different about hygiene or scientific things that we... all these animals that were unclean, unsafe to eat, and all the clean animals safe to eat. I don't know if you ever pay attention to the news, but you can still get sick eating cow meat. Did you know that? I hope you're not quite that oblivious to what goes on. So it doesn't have anything to do with practical health. The whole point of the law, you can't understand the law unless you understand that the whole point of the law has to do with being in God's presence. That's the whole point of the law. Everything in the law has something to do with being in God's presence, because that's what God wants for you. God didn't create you, okay, let's see who does best at following with all these rules. God didn't create you. Okay, let's see who proves themselves better than someone else. God didn't create you to see, let's see who could do the most things to impress me. That's not what God created you to do. God created you because he wants to love you and exchange love with you, get your love in return, have what we typically call a relationship with God. Well, if we use that phrase correctly, what we mean is living in God's presence. Relationship with God doesn't mean the things that you do as a consequence of your relationship with God. Reading the Bible, prayer, and so forth, that is not your relationship with God. Those are things you do as a consequence of your relationship with God. Your relationship with God means you're living in God's presence. The basic concepts of the law, and I've taught whole classes on Leviticus, and I know you don't want to read any Leviticus this morning. You're already still tired from that emotional ordeal last night. But basically, to understand the law, you have to realize that God's presence is the key concept, and then you have two basic contrasts that run throughout the law. The difference between the holy and the common, and Leviticus fans,
clean and
unclean. Right. See, Cecilia knows that one. She's a good big Leviticus fan. The point is that God tells you, you want to live in his presence, you got to be which of these two?
Holy.
Okay. That wasn't hard. See, Leviticus isn't that hard. You want to live in God's presence, you got to be which of these two?
Clean.
Clean, right? See, it's not hard. Every law teaches you principles. Every law, the habits that the ancient Jews got into were not to teach them who was superior and who wasn't. The designation, these people are to be priests. They have to meet certain criteria. It wasn't that that makes them better. It's because they were going to go in God's presence. And God was teaching you, being in God's presence is something very special. It's something that demands holiness. It's something that demands cleanness. And the kicker is, you can't do that yourself. Only absolute perfection is acceptable in God's presence. And all those laws were so misunderstood, as many of the comments have pointed out, and we still misunderstand them today. We still misunderstand it because we still follow rules for rules' sake. We still want to evaluate ourselves vis-a-vis someone else instead of realizing the standard of holiness and cleanness, we all get the same score. Failing. We don't do that on our own. We've got to be cleansed by the blood of Christ, but the blood of Christ always cleanses you 100%. Makes you holy, makes you clean, helps you to live in God's presence. And you can apply that to a lot of things in the old law. If you look at the old law with these principles in mind, much of it makes a lot more sense. And you won't fall into a lot of the misconceptions that people have made up because it's hard for them to see things from God's point of view. Specifically in terms of what he's saying here, he's saying, therefore, eunuchs, foreigners, people who the law said you may have to have some apparent disadvantages, that doesn't mean anything in terms of your relationship with God because you're just as in need of grace as anybody else. The ceremonies and the sacrifices were to teach you this complicated system of offering goats and doves and everything. That's only to atone for your sins temporarily. Even all that didn't forgive them. Only the blood of Christ could forgive them. And it was to lead people, as Galatians said, as a schoolmaster to Christ, to help you see this. And therefore, the house of God truly can be a house of prayer for all nations. And he says in verse 8, the sovereign Lord declares, he who gathers the exiles of Israel, see, Israel itself was looking forward to being able to return and to be able to overcome the discipline and the punishment. But then here's the little extra point. He says, I will gather still others to them besides those already gathered. Don't ever think, Israel, that it's just about you. Because it never was, and it never will be. It's always been about everybody. And we have a bad habit of arbitrarily excluding in our minds certain kinds of people from being able to share in the grace of God. And we have a bad habit of comparing ourselves based on our knowledge, our superior performance, our superior devotion to God. Those are all the kind of thoughts that God says, I'm above those things. I've always been above those things. And the rest of this passage, I won't read it in detail because we're running out of time, and it's a lot of things Isaiah's talked about before. But he talks about here in the end of chapter 56 and chapter 57, he says, for example, chapter 56, verse 10, Israel's watchmen are blind. They lack knowledge. They are mute dogs. They cannot bark. They lie around and dream. They love to sleep. They're dogs with mighty appetites. They never have enough. Talking about, you look out there in the world, you got a lot of people that they just see this world as a big smorgasbord. Eat, drink, indulge yourself, have fun. Then you got people, chapter 57, the righteous perish and no one ponders in his heart. Devout men are taken away and no one understands. A lot of people just look at the world with blank understanding, panic, fear, terror, not know what's going on. And for the most part, the worldly kind of sway back and forth between those two kind of extremes. We get thrown into a tizzy by anything unexpected. And sometimes we're just tempted to go off and do whatever we feel like. And the thing that he talks about here is he just kind of gets at a couple of the root problems. The reason why we see so much sin out there is because no one just stops to think about things from God's point of view. And then when we do, we find it a lot easier to attach ourselves to idols, to things of this world that promise some kind of false security, instead of the things that would really help us. And so what he says is to, as he said before, come let us reason together, call on him while he is near. And don't take God's patience for granted, because God loves us enough that he's going to give us a lot of opportunities to kind of wake up to what's happening around us. But he says down in verse 13, when you cry out for help, let your collection of idols save you. Don't wait till it's too late, because those idols of the world aren't going to save you. Realize that God is the one who's going to save you. You know, a lot of you, I'm sure, get caught up with all the news and all the things. You know, we're all in a tizzy now about the financial markets. Well, is there any problem that exists now that didn't exist a few weeks ago? No. Now all of a sudden, it's a crisis. It's a crisis. It's a meltdown. We need a bailout. I'll tell you what, you want to understand all the things that's going on. I don't have time to lecture you about it, but you better start by ignoring all the things that they're saying on the news. If you want to understand what's really going on, you better ignore all the things the politicians are saying, because they're all presenting it in superficial emotional terms. They're all looking to see how they can get you to be as scared as you can, as upset as you can, because that makes it easier for them to manipulate you to their own advantage. See, God doesn't do that. God doesn't manipulate. God doesn't try to get us where he wants us so that he can push us around. God says, could we just sit down and think about this? Could you really ask yourself, is this world really ever going to provide you with what you really need? Or do I have what you really need? And I've got to leave you go, because we're running a little late again. But just to point out, he says, the person who makes me his refuge will inherit the land and possess my holy mountains. When we cry out to God, are we just looking for him to bail us out of this crisis that we're facing? Or are we looking to him for a refuge, a permanent home away from the turmoil of this world? Because that's what God is offering. God doesn't want to be a fire extinguisher, you know, break glass in case of absolute emergency. God wants to live with you, to have you live in his presence, to have you aware of him and what's important to him, and to live that way so that these crises and things that the world gets all upset by, you're able to rise above them. You're able to still have peace and joy and security, and walk through the world and have the mountains singing and the trees clapping their hands. I gotta let you go. Thanks a lot for your patience. We'll pick up here in the middle of chapter 57 next week.
Yes. Yeah.